Good evening. With the House January 6th committee gearing up for its primetime finale tomorrow, we begin tonight with a headline that makes as good a case as any for the committee's existence and certainly underscores a threat to democracy that's not gone away. Now, at first, you might think it's a typo, but it's not. Wisconsin Assembly Speaker says Trump called him this month to decertify 2020 election. That's the headline. Now, the story comes in the wake of a state court ruling on ballot drop boxes in future elections, not the last one. Quotes Wisconsin's Assembly Speaker, a Republican, as saying that the former president called him last week trying to overturn his 2020 defeat. Last week, as the speaker put it, I explained it's not allowed under the Constitution, adding, quote, he has a different opinion. In other words, Trump may be sweating and stewing in Mar-a-Lago, but he is still at it. And there were other warning signs today as well. Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, remember him? Lifelong Republican who refused to buckle to pressure from the former president and who testified emotionally before the select committee. Well, we learned he was just censured by the state party, which declared him no longer a Republican in good standing. In Maryland last night, primary voters chose Dan Cox, a proponent of the 2020 election lie, to be their Republican nominee for governor. Now, he once called on the former president to seize voting machines. He also sponsored buses to take people to the so-called Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. And that afternoon, he tweeted, Mike Pence is a traitor. So there's that. There's also this we got today having to do with a former White House aide named Garrett Ziegler. According to the New York Times, he escorted Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell into the White House for that unhinged meeting on December 18th. Ziegler met with the select committee earlier this week and said this afterwards about the members on Telegram.
They're Bolsheviks, so they probably do hate the American founders and most white people in general. This is a Bolshevistic anti-white campaign. If you can't see that, your eyes are freaking closed. And so they see me as a young Christian who they can try to basically scare, right?
That guy was an aide to the president. This went on for 27 minutes, during which Ziegler also used vulgar and misogynistic language to attack two other witnesses, Cassidy Hutchinson and Alyssa Farah Griffin. As for the missing Secret Service text messages from the six, well, today we learned that of the messages sent or received by 24 individuals, the agency has only managed to provide the select committee with one single exchange. Committee leadership in a statement late today said they have concerns. So if all that falls on what you might call the debit side of the balance sheet, there are also new items on the other side. A New York judge today ordering Rudy Giuliani to appear before the Georgia grand jury probing election interference there. A bipartisan group of senators today reaching agreement on legislation beefing up the Electoral Count Act, which, if passed, would make it harder to do what the former president did in 2020. And Attorney General Garland today gave the strongest signal yet that when it comes to bringing criminal charges in connection with what the former president did, no one is immune from prosecution.
No person is above the law in this country. I can't say it any more clearly than that. There is nothing in the principles of prosecution, in any other factors which prevent us from investigating anyone, anyone who is criminally responsible for an attempt to undo a Democratic election.
As for the committee's business tomorrow, the final hearing expected to focus on what the former president did and, more importantly, probably did not do for 3 hours and 7 minutes as the mob he invited, then incited, ransacked the Capitol. Expected to testify, former Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews and former Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger. Here's some of what they have already told the committee in video testimony about what they saw during that time.
We had all talked about at that point about how it was bad and the, situation was getting out of hand. I think when Kaylee gave us that order of don't say anything to the media, I told her that I thought the president needed to tweet something.
One of my staff brought me a printout of a tweet by the president.
We all got a notification, so we knew it was a tweet from the president, and we looked down, and it was a tweet about Mike Pence.
And the tweet said something to the effect that Mike Pence, the vice president, didn't have the courage to do what should have been done.
I remember us saying that that was the last thing that needed to be tweeted at that moment. The situation was already bad And so it felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that.
I read that tweet and made a decision at that moment to resign. That's where I knew that I was leaving that day.
Again, tonight, it's a lot. Joining us now is Maryland Democratic Congressman and House Select Committee member Jamie Raskin. So, Congressman, what more should we expect to learn, do you think, from these witnesses who are testifying tomorrow, Pottinger and Matthews?
Well, generally, we're going to see what Donald Trump was doing and what he was not doing during that 187-minute fateful period of American history. He continued to exhort and inflame and incite the crowd. He continued to direct extremely negative comments towards Vice President Pence, saying he didn't have the courage to do what needed to be done. He obviously inflamed the crowd in the morning, saying you got to fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. Yeah. He directed them at the Capitol and so on. And those two witnesses both have very individual, specific stories to tell, and I think I'll keep everybody in suspense until tomorrow for them.
The Washington Post is just up with some reporting within really the past few minutes that the committee is planning to show outtakes from remarks the former president delivered January 7th. Can you tell us any more about that?
Well, the president displayed extreme difficulty in completing his remarks. Of course, you know, hours had passed when he could have simply taken a walk for 10 or 15 seconds over to address the country and address his followers and tell them to go home. And people were beseeching him, begging him to do that, and he refused to do that. So then he finally went over and made some comments at the end of the day when it was clear that, no thanks to the president, our police forces had turned the tide and were beginning to, you know, win back the Capitol. And at that point, he got on and said, we love you, you're very special, and, you know, time to go home and so on. But it's extremely revealing how exactly he went about making those statements, and we're going to let everybody see parts of that.
So this was the statement, just so I'm clear, this was the statement that he made on the day of the insurrection, or was it the day after?
Oh, I guess you're referring to the one the day after when he made another speech, but also, you know, there was a statement made on the day of at the end of the
and
day.
And you have outtakes on that one as well.
No, actually, I'm not sure we've got outtakes on that one. It's the other one we've got outtakes on, but we certainly have snippets from this one, also on the 6th.
You have snippets of the one on the 6th.
Yeah.
Obviously, your investigation is ongoing. What does the committee's timeline look, and you may not know, what does the committee's timeline look like after tomorrow's hearing? I mean, what do you do the next day? Is there a ballpark for when you plan to issue a final report, potential criminal referrals to the Justice Department, if there will be any, other hearings?
Well, this should be the end of this block of hearings, but never say never in this process because new material and new evidence is surfacing all the time. But I think that the committee is continuing the investigation. There are some important new leads that have opened up, so I wouldn't be surprised if there could be another hearing or two down the road. And certainly we need to do a hearing to discuss our conclusions and the recommendations that we're making for fortification of American democracy against coups and insurrections and political violence and attempts to steal away the will of the people and take over elections, which is what we saw with January 6th, and which, alas, continues to go on with the same forces that were arrayed against us on that day.
And the story that the Wisconsin Assembly Speaker said the former president called him last week as part of a fresh effort to decertify the state's 2020 election results. What does it say to you that, I mean, he's down in Mar-a-Lago playing golf, but he's even now trying to overturn election results while your investigation is ongoing?
Well, to me, what it says is that although Donald Trump knows full well that he lost the election by more than 7 million votes and 306 to 232 in the Electoral College, even though everyone around him knew that and knows that and tried to convince him of it, he still wants to propagandize his followers in the big lie. I mean, for him, it's become a litmus test also for politicians like Mastriano in Pennsylvania or Dan Cox in Maryland. These people are true believers who will follow anything that the cult leader has to say. And so he uses it as a litmus test to see who's loyal to him and who's not. It's a very scary and degraded thing to see this take place in the world's first modern democracy.
Yeah. Congressman Raskin, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I want to get perspective now from conservative attorney and Washington Post contributing columnist George Conway, also CNN special correspondent Jamie Gangel. Jamie, given what Pottinger and Matthews witnessed in the White House on January 6th, what do you expect to hear in their testimony tomorrow?
Anderson, I'm told that it's going to be very dramatic. These were two White House aides who were in the White House on January 6th. They are firsthand fact witnesses. I'm told that Sarah Matthews will talk about how they tried to get Trump to say something, but could not. And Matt Pottinger, we should know, he was at the White House for 4 years on the National Security staff. He knew Trump well. I'm told he did not see Trump on the 6th, but he did see Mark Meadows. There will be key testimony about that. And also, as we've reported, they both resigned that day. I think that that is key to this point of dereliction of duty. One source told me that they were both very upset because Trump wouldn't say to the rioters, stop, leave, and that these two aides will say he didn't say that because he didn't want them to stop and leave.
George, I want to play what Attorney General Merrick Garland, some more of what he said today.
No person is above the law in this country. Nothing stops us.
Even a former president.
No person is above the law in this country. I can't say it any more clearly than that. There is nothing in the principles of prosecution, in any other factors which prevent us from investigating anyone. Anyone who's criminally responsible for an attempt to undo a Democratic election.
Do you think that changes if Trump runs? I mean, you know, it's one thing to say that, but if the former president announces he's running, does that change the calculus for the Department of Justice potentially?
Not at all. It shouldn't. In fact, it should enhance the calculus for the Department of Justice, because what we're going to see tomorrow is something that we've never seen. In 233 years, we've had presidents of the United States. The first president, George Washington, sworn in 233 years ago. And this January 6th was the single worst day of the presidency, because you had a president who went AWOL, who basically he engaged in the supreme dereliction of his duty when a crowd was attempting to stop the peaceful transfer of power, was attempting to basically overthrow the Constitution. We had a president of the United States who was sworn to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, who did nothing for 187 minutes. And we're going to hear evidence of how he did nothing, which was to ignore people who are telling him, please do something, Mr. President, and to watch television. We haven't heard the testimony yet, but we know from published reports that he was just watching television gleefully. And this is something we've never, ever seen before, and it goes to his criminal intent. He did everything he could to overturn that election for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And then between 1:10 p.m. and 4:17 p.m. on January 6, 2021, he did nothing. And the reason why he did nothing, you know, in contrast, the energetic attempts to overthrow the election that preceded it, was he viewed the attack on the Capitol as an effort, as one more way to try to overturn the election result. And that's criminal. And if Attorney General Garland means what he says, it should be prosecuted.
Yeah, you know, Jamie, I'm not even sure the phrasing that he did nothing is accurate, because, in fact, by doing nothing, he was, in fact, doing all he could to encourage the attack, to continue the attack, to prolong the attack, clearly because he wanted it to succeed. He wanted to see Would they reach Mike Pence? Would they stop the vote? I mean, it wasn't just he didn't know what to do and he wasn't doing anything. He was watching the well-laid plans that he'd no doubt discussed with, you know, Steve Bannon and his cronies and Field Marshal Mike Flynn play out.
No question about it. And you may remember we've had reporting that, in fact, not only was he watching it, he was rewinding it to watch it again, that he was enjoying this. And I think we're going to hear a lot about that also from someone else who is at the White House. And that is White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who my sources tell me that testimony will be on videotape, but I'm told we will see a lot of Pat Cipollone, that he is a star witness tomorrow. And there is a reason the committee pushed so hard to get Pat Cipollone to give this videotape testimony. I am told we will see just why tomorrow when they show it.
And George, do you think any of the former president's associates or allies, like you know, former chief of staff Mark Meadows, could face legal exposure in the wake of these hearings?
Absolutely. I mean, Mark Meadows was facilitating all of this. He was facilitating the rally. He facilitated Team Crazy coming in. He was in the thick of it. And he definitely, absolutely, and he has had involvement with the situation in Georgia where they were trying to put the arm on Raffensperger to find those votes. Meadows is very, very deeply involved here, and he's very deeply exposed.
Yeah. George Conway, Jimmy Gangale, thank you. Appreciate it. Next, the prosecution resting in Steve Bannon's contempt of Congress trial. After showing the jury evidence of his defiance in his own words, we'll tell you how the defense might rebut that and the rest of what looks like a very clear case and what Bannon is really up to when we continue. And later, whether it's wildfires, which you've been watching, these rising temperatures, falling water levels, or just plain human misery, we're going to bring you the latest, what is now a global heat wave. More AC360 to come after the break. Three days into the contempt of Congress trial of Steve Bannon, the prosecution has rested, but not before the defense in cross-examination again tried to portray the former president's one-time political strategist as willing to cooperate with the House January 6th committee, and not before the prosecution showed more evidence he was defying it openly. More now from CNN's Sarah Murray, who was inside the D.C. federal courtroom. So the judge is allowing questions about Bannon's recent Hail Mary bid to cooperate with the January 6th committee. How did that play out?
Well, that's right. And as part of it, Bannon's attorney was asking this House Select Committee staffer, so, you know, you guys have been in contact with him. Are you still open to getting information? And the Select Committee staffer said, you know, we are still open to getting information. But when prosecutors circled back with her on the redirect, they pointed out, hey, these recent letters, Benny Thompson very clearly states, even if you give us information now, this doesn't mean that you complied with a subpoena. You still defied it. The contempt of Congress stuff still stands. They also narrowed in on the fact that Bannon did not make this offer right after he was charged. He did not make this offer in the months that followed that. He only came to the committee with this offer on July 10th, which was about a week before he was set to go to trial, Anderson.
The defense also used a book club membership to try and show bias of the January 6th committee staffer who testified. What was that about?
Yeah, you know, the defense doesn't have a lot that they can argue in this trial. One of the things they can try to make the case is that, you know, perhaps someone who was involved in this was biased. So they pointed to the fact that this House Select Committee staffer and one of the prosecutors on this case used to be in a book club together as a suggestion that, you know, perhaps this witness was biased. In reality, neither of these two women have even been to the book club in the past year. So we'll see how that sits with the jury, Anderson.
And in terms of a timeline, do we know how soon the jury might begin deliberations?
Well, the caveat is always you can't predict what is going to happen in court, right? Tomorrow, the defense gets to put forward their case. What we don't know is if the defense is going to put a case on. We don't know if they're actually going to call any witnesses, and we don't know if they're going to call on Steve Bannon and if he's going to take the stand and testify on his own behalf. So that's a big question. If they don't put forward a case, if they don't put forward witnesses, it's possible this could go to the jurors tomorrow.
Sarah Murray, appreciate it. Thanks. We are always glad at moments like these to be joined by Bloomberg Businessweek national correspondent Joshua Green, author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming the Presidency. Also, CNN chief legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin, a former federal prosecutor. Jeff Toobin, just on what went on today, what do you think of the developments?
You know, when you hear that a case is just two witnesses and basically a day of testimony, you think, wait a second, there has to be something more to this. And the answer is no, there is nothing more to this.
I mean, not even the book club?
That's right. That was the big gotcha in the cross-examination. There's nothing to this case. He got a subpoena. He didn't show up. He didn't produce the documents. He didn't challenge it in court. He didn't try to get a delay. He bragged that he didn't cooperate. That's the whole case. I mean, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty, except he's guilty. I mean, there's just nothing to this case.
Josh, when you and I last spoke, you said one of Bannon's biggest motivations would be to try to create as big a spectacle as possible, undermine the January 6th committee. I mean, he tried to do that yesterday with this, you know, statement he made outside the courtroom, sort of trying to challenge, you know, Benny Thompson in a mano-a-mano, you know, arm wrestling tournament or something if he would show up in court. It just looked kind of sad, but what do you think of what did Bannon get out of this?
I don't think he got anything out of it. If anything, I think it backfired on him because the judge in court today said, and surely he was alluding to this, he said, quote, you know, I do not intend for this to become a political circus. And at every stage, he has shut down Bannon and his defense's efforts to turn it into one by subpoenaing Nancy Pelosi and all these other sorts of things he wants to do to kind of seize control. So it really will be interesting to see whether the defense allows him to testify on his own behalf, because it's hard to imagine him, you know, being on good behavior and not sort of exploding in some way that you know, undermines what little case the defense seems to have.
Jeff, I mean, do you think Bannon would actually testify?
You know, I think this is classic bully behavior. You know, when you're standing at a press conference, it's like, we're going to go medieval on their asses.
Right,
you know, and then on his podcast, he's like the big tough guy. But when it comes to testifying under oath, where you have to follow the rules of evidence, where you're subject to cross-examination, I don't think he's going to go anywhere near the witness stand because that's not the forum he will excel in.
Josh, does Steve Bannon still matter at all? I mean, yes, he was once in the cover of Time. Yes, he was involved in the president's campaign. Then he was out of the orbit. I know he's supposedly building this network of, you know, people who are going to run for school boards and stuff and try to destroy institutions from inside. Is that for real? Is that something people should be worried about? Or is he just this, you know, dude with a podcast and there's a lot of them?
No, I think what he's doing is real, and I think he's got a bigger role than that. I mean, he is still, as we can see from what we know about what happened on January 6th in the days and weeks leading up to it, he is still the chief propagandist for Donald Trump, you know, spinning this alternate narrative that is powerful enough that, you know, thousands of people showed up at the Capitol and rioted, and countless Republicans still, you know, believe this misinformation about how Joe Biden isn't the rightful president. I think Steve Bannon has a big hand in spinning that narrative. But again, it is all based on fantasy and hyperbole and nonsense. And it's hard to kind of lean on that when you're under oath in court.
If he's convicted, Jeff, I mean, what?
Well,
it's a misdemeanor.
It's a very weird statute where misdemeanors are usually no jail time required and a year maximum. The two counts each carry a 30-day minimum. So if he's convicted of both counts, he's looking at 60 days at a minimum in jail. He could get more. But, I mean, this is not a big jail.
Can he podcast from jail?
I doubt it. only Jeffrey Epstein gets to live his life that way when he's incarcerated.
Really?
Yeah, he did for a while, anyway.
Yeah. Didn't end well.
No.
Jeff Toobin, Josh Green, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Coming up, an election denier wins the Republican nomination for governor in Maryland after Democrats spent more than $1 million trying to turn out support for that right-wing candidate. David Axelrod joins us next to discuss this controversial high-risk strategy. There's concern and criticism tonight over Democratic strategy to help fund far-right candidates in Republican primaries. The plan is that these candidates, if nominated, would be so toxic for moderate voters that it would help Democrats. The fear is they might actually win election. The latest is Dan Cox, who CNN projects will win the Republican nomination for governor in Maryland. Cox is an election denier. After the 2020 election, he said the former president should seize voting machines. He also chartered three buses to the January 6th rally, and he tweeted during the attack on the Capitol, quote, Pence is a traitor. According to Open Secrets, a news site that tracks politics and money, Democrats spent more than $1 million on TV ads highlighting the former president's endorsement of Cox, a tactic which was designed to boost his candidacy during the primary with Republicans, but also harm it during the general election. Open Secrets also reports that Democrats have spent nearly $44 million on ad campaigns in at least five states, California, Colorado, Pennsylvania, Illinois, as well as Maryland. Joined now by CNN senior political commentator David Axelrod and former senior advisor to President Obama. David, is this a smart strategy?
Well, we'll see. It's certainly been smart in the short run if the goal is to nominate extreme candidates who you think will be easier to beat. But the reason that they're going to these lengths is that this could be a very tough year for Democrats. There are gale force winds blowing against Democrats, and so they wanted the most beatable candidates. But those gale force winds could actually blow one of these candidates in. And you know, Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, who's quite extreme on elections, on abortion, on many other issues, not unlike Cox. He's right. You know, the initial polls in that race after he was nominated had him 4 points behind the Democratic candidate. So, you know, it could be shrewd or it could end disastrously. And that's the danger, Anderson.
Democrats have done this before, most notably the 2012 Senate race in Missouri, where Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill helped Republican Congressman Todd Akin to get on the ballot against her. That was successful for her. Has it ever been done on this scale with this much at stake?
No. Yes, that Akin race, that McCaskill race, it took on mythic importance or significance, and people reached into that grab bag this year. And what happened was it started in Pennsylvania in the Mastriano race. It proved successful, though I think Mastriano might have won anyway, and then it transported to Illinois, onto Colorado in a Senate race where it didn't actually work, and these other states. Yesterday was noteworthy because the candidate who won, Cox, I think spent only $21,000 from his own campaign. Wow. The Democratic Governors Association spent over $1 million. And remember, these ads are not—they're not distorting their records; they're amplifying them. They're—you know—most of these ads are the same. They say too conservative for Maryland, too conservative for Pennsylvania, but it says they're anti-abortion, they're pro-Trump. They've—you know—and they go through all the credentials that will make them objectionable in theory to moderate voters, but are music to the ears of core base Trump-oriented primary voters. And, you know, it obviously has worked to great effect in several of these cases.
I mean, it is a little weird to have Democrats, you know, warning that some of these candidates are a threat to democracy and at the very same time making sure that they win their primaries and are on the ballot in November. I mean...
Yeah, listen, Anderson, you know, I spent 30 years in campaigns or thereabouts. And, you know, I'm not an ingenue, and I understand the idea is to win, and I understand the thinking behind these tactics. But as I said earlier, they come with great risk. And, you know, you're handling plutonium here as it relates to democracy. And if something goes wrong, if those gale force winds are such that, you know, a Republican is blown across the finish line, you'll have people like in Pennsylvania, the governor there appoints the Secretary of State who administers the elections. So this has the potential to be a disaster if it goes wrong. So like, as I said at the beginning, it may seem smart today. It may seem tragically wrong in November.
David, I bet you are mistaken often for an ingenue, though.
No, a lot of people say, you'd be surprised. I get that all the time.
I have to go look up the exact definition of ingenue.
I should, too, now that I've said it on national television.
Lastly, there's been a lot of reporting about President Trump running for president again. The narrative is more of when he'll announce, when he'll announce, or will he announce, not when. Do you think he will?
I think he will. Yeah, I think, you know, he's not very subtle. He generally signals what he's going to do, and he's been signaling that he's going to do this. And I think all of these legal threats probably encourage him to do it. The ascension of people like DeSantis encourage him to do it. And his need to be the center of attention encourages him to do it. But I'll tell you what, there is a group of people who don't want him to do it, and that's Republican office holders. And there are a group of people who do, and that's Democratic office holders and strategists. If he plunges himself into the middle of these midterm elections, he could change the equation in a dramatic way.
Interesting. David Axelrod, I appreciate it.
Good to see you.
Just ahead, the extreme heat that is fueling fires in Europe and forcing Yellowstone National Park to issue a new high-level fire warning. And in China, complicating efforts to maintain their controversial zero-COVID policy. We have a stunning live report from Beijing next. Europe right now is battling wildfires caused by the extreme global heat that many of us are living through right now. Just outside of Athens, Greece, firefighters spent a second day trying to control blazes that have been fueled in part by strong winds. Firefighters from Romania also assisting in battling the deadly fires. At least 600 have been evacuated, including a children's hospital. In the United States, Yellowstone National Park now warns that the area is under a high fire danger level. There are no active wildfires right now, but they say a high fire danger level means wildfires are likely and that they could be difficult to control in certain areas under certain windy conditions. As CNN's Selena Wang reports from China, the extreme heat has complicated an already tough situation for that country's zero COVID policy.
Scorching temperatures sweep over China, turning mass COVID testing into a dangerous task. State media shows COVID workers collapsing on the job due to what the videos say are heat stroke. In eastern China, a COVID worker vomits on the ground as colleagues rush to tear off her hazmat suit. Unable to stand, she's carried away. It's a scene playing out across China. Fainting, falling, crumpling on the ground, lying motionless, struggling to breathe. The COVID worker's long hours in the suffocating heat made worse by their head-to-toe full body protective gear. That is not water, according to state media. It's sweat gushing out of this worker's hazmat suit. The sweat pools inside the protective gear, lining the inside of their rubber gloves. The surging temperatures coinciding with surging COVID cases.
Cities across China, including here in Beijing, require a recent COVID test in order to enter any public area. That means everyone, young, old, and sick, all have to wait in long lines like these in the brutal heat.
It's really hot. It's frustrating and, you know, exhausting. And you feel like, and a lot of times you feel anxious because you have things to do.
To survive, COVID workers are getting creative, hugging giant blocks of ice, placing them on their backs, laps, and feet. Colleagues rub ice on each other and tape ice-cold water bottles to themselves. Some authorities have now said COVID workers can wear PPE that does not cover their entire bodies. Dozens of cities have been experiencing record-high temperatures. Last week, more than 80 cities issued red alerts, with some logging temperatures of more than 110 degrees Fahrenheit. In central China, a museum closed after the roof melted. In Nanjing, the city opened underground air raid shelters for people to escape the heat. Meanwhile, crops are withering and dying under the high temperatures, the soil parched and cracked. The damage to China's crop production threatens to push up inflation, putting more pressure on an economy already devastated by the pandemic. But in zero COVID China, even healthcare workers hospitalized from heat exhaustion get a positive spin from authorities. This propaganda video shows government officials visiting COVID workers in the intensive care unit. While showing the motionless patients in bed, the video rallies people to work together for victory against COVID.
Selena Wang joins me now from Beijing. The video in your piece is stunning. Have we already seen the worst of the heat wave in China? Is it going to get better?
Well, Anderson, we have seen temperatures start to come down in parts of the country, but after that, things could still get worse with more extreme weather expected in the coming months. Now, this heat wave actually follows extreme flooding in China that has displaced millions of people. And this hitting a population that is still reeling from this harsh COVID lockdown that's making it more suffocating for people trapped at home and more dangerous, as you saw, for those frontline healthcare workers. Now, according to a government report temperatures in China are actually rising faster than the global average, which can make this extreme weather events more frequent, more intense. China is now making climate change a top priority. But the question is, all of this too late?
And I mean, it looks like these are sort of propaganda videos the Chinese government is making about the COVID workers collapsing. What's the message they're sending with these?
Yeah, some of the videos were very striking. The last one, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a celebration of the sacrifice, but they're showing an example that these healthcare workers collapsing over and over again, being in the ICU for heat stroke, it shows the amount of sacrifice and dedication that these frontline workers are giving towards trying to fight COVID. It kind of fits into this more militant rhetoric in China towards trying to combat this virus. They're treating it like an all-out war battle on the pandemic, and that it's a reminder. The music at the end you saw there was motivational. It's a reminder to people that this is a time where everybody needs to play their part. Anderson.
Selina Wang, appreciate it. Here in the U.S., a once powerful, now disbarred attorney charged with murdering his wife and youngest son. What Alex Murdoch told a judge today about the charges against him. More AC 360 to come after the break. Disgraced former South Carolina attorney Alex Murdoch has pleaded not guilty to all charges in connection to the murders of his wife and son, who were found shot to death last year. Just after the killings, Murdoch was thought by many to be a grieving widower. Then came more twists and turns than what you'd find on a South Carolina country road, culminating in an indictment last week on two counts of murder and two counts of possession of a weapon during the commission of a violent crime for the two deaths. With more on what happened in court today, here's our Randy Kaye, and a warning, some of the language is graphic.
Alex Murdoch arriving at South Carolina's Colleton County Courthouse to face murder charges. By the time he entered the courtroom, he'd changed from his blue jail jumpsuit into street clothes and Gucci shoes, all of which we've learned belong to one of his lawyer's sons.
What say you, Richard Alex Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
Murdoch pleaded not guilty to murdering his wife, Maggie, and youngest son, Paul, on June 7th last year. The two were found shot to death at the family's property in Islington, South Carolina.
I need the police to pass this immediately. My wife and child shot badly.
And what is your name?
My name is Alex Murdoch.
Alex Murdoch called 911. He said he found them shot after returning from visiting his mother. But just last week, he was charged with killing them. Both were shot multiple times, according to the indictment. Maggie with a rifle and Paul with a shotgun. A source with knowledge of the investigation confirmed to CNN Alex Murdoch had blood spatter on his clothes, which could prove he was in close proximity to at least one of the victims when they were shot. No motive has been disclosed. In court today, attorneys on both sides requested a gag order and refused to speak with the media.
Evidence in this case is substantial, and it all points back to Alex Murdoch.
Murdoch's attorneys also requested a speedy trial beginning this fall.
He believes he's innocent. He believes that the killer or killers are still at large, and this would allow Sled to put this behind him and go look for the real killers.
Alex Murdoch said nothing beyond his not guilty plea. He sat at the defense table not far from a portrait on the wall of his grandfather, who served as solicitor here until 1986. Murdoch has been in jail charged with dozens of financial crimes since September last year. CNN has obtained over 13 hours of recordings of his jailhouse phone calls. He often talked with his only surviving son, Buster, about football, gambling, jailhouse workouts, and plans for when, perhaps if, he gets out.
We got a good deal with all mom's. Since when I get out, I got a good deal with all mom's stuff in storage.
At one point, they talked about guns.
So you don't have your 20 gauge?
Yeah, I've got my 20 gauge, but I don't have... I mean, they took all the 12 gauges and they took all the assault rifles.
In one phone call from jail, Alex referred to a TV report he saw and mentioned the names Stephen Smith and Gloria Satterfield, two people in Murdoch's orbit who mysteriously died.
I mean, it's just that same old...
Stephen Smith and Gloria and all that bullshit. Like there's some mystery surrounding Gloria's death, about how she died.
Gloria Satterfield died in 2018 after falling down the steps at Murdoch's home. Smith was found dead on a rural road in 2015. Both of those deaths are now under investigation by the state. Meanwhile, following court today, Murdoch once again returned to jail, where he is being held on a $7 million bond on charges of financial crimes, including insurance fraud.
Randy joins us now from Charleston, South Carolina. Did the prosecution give any hints in court today about possible motive?
Anderson, no clear motive was spelled out in court today, but the prosecutor certainly hinted at what may be to come. He noted these 81 allegations that Alex Murdoch is facing for fraud, for drugs, for financial crimes, all things that the grand jury had to consider when they decided to indict him in this double murder case. So the prosecutor said in court today, quote, a lot of that provides the background and motive for what happened on June 7th, 2021. That was the day of the double murder when Alex Murdoch's wife and son were both killed. So certainly he's trying to connect some of this history to a possible motive, it seems. We'll see what the defense has to say about that, Anderson.
Randy, thanks very much. Up next, the former president and close family members gather to say goodbye to Ivana Trump. Today here in New York City, mourners gather for Ivana Trump's funeral, including the former president, their three children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump. The first wife of the former president is being remembered as a loving mom, a grandmother, powerful businesswoman who helped build the family's real estate empire, such as it was. The former president on a social media platform called it a very sad day, but at the same time, a celebration of a wonderful and beautiful life. Ivana Trump was found unconscious, unresponsive at the bottom of a staircase in her townhouse last week. Authorities say she died of blunt impact injuries to her torso. Ivana Trump was 73. That's it for this episode of AC360. You can check out our lineup of podcasts and showcasts at cnn.com/podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.